prevent you from falling below the line at one time or another. Nobody's perfect. Everyone, even the highest achievers in our complex interrelated society, can get stuck in the victim cycle on occasion. But those who believe in accountability never remain there for long. People and organizations operating below the line consciously or unconsciously avoid accountability for results. Languishing in the victim cycle, they begin to lose their spirit and will, until eventually they feel powerless, just as Dorothy and her friends did. If they choose to continue feeling victimized, they will move through predictable stages in an unending cycle that thwarts individual and organizational productivity, ignoring or pretending not to know about their accountability, claiming it's not their job, ducking their responsibility, blaming others for their predicament, citing confusion as an excuse for inaction, asking others to tell them what to do, claiming that they can't do it, developing their story for why they are not at fault, and finally waiting to see if some hoped-for miracle will be bestowed by an imaginary wizard. How to recognize when you're below the line. Whenever you get stuck in the victim cycle, you can't get unstuck until you first acknowledge that you're functioning below the line and paying a high price for it. Only with that acknowledgement can you begin assuming a see-it attitude that gives you the perspective you need to get above the line. Oftentimes, unable to overcome the inertia of the victim cycle on your own, you need feedback from an objective person, such as a friend or spouse, or, as in the case of GE, a customer in Philadelphia with a failed refrigerator compressor. However, you can greatly improve your ability to recognize your predicament by looking for one or more of the following telltale clues. You feel held captive by your circumstances. You feel you lack any control over your present circumstances. You don't listen when others tell you, directly or indirectly, that they think you could have done more to achieve better results. You find yourself blaming others and pointing fingers. Your discussions of problems focus more on what you cannot do rather than on what you can do. You fail to confront the toughest issues you face. You find yourself being sought out by others so they can tell you what someone else did to them this time. You resist asking probing questions about your own accountability. You feel you are being treated unfairly and you don't think you can do anything about it. You repeatedly find yourself in a defensive posture. You spend a lot of time talking about things you cannot change, e.g. your boss, shareholders, the economy's performance, government regulations. You cite your confusion as a reason for not taking action. You avoid the people, the meetings, and the situations that require you to report on your responsibilities. You find yourself saying, "It's not my job. There's nothing I can do about it. Someone ought to tell him. All we can do is wait and see. Just tell me what you want me to do. If it were me, I'd do it differently." You frequently waste time and energy boss or colleague bashing. You spend valuable time crafting a compelling story detailing why you were not at fault. You repeatedly tell the same old story about how someone took advantage of you. And you view the world with a pessimistic attitude. If you detect any of these signs in yourself, your team, or your organization, act immediately to help yourself or someone else recognize those excuses for what they are, impediments to accountability and results. Once this recognition occurs, you and others can begin to understand the nuances and subtleties of the victim cycle, just as Dorothy and her companions ultimately did. Common stages of the victim cycle. While the victim cycle can be bafflingly complex, we have identified six basic stages common to most people and organizations. As you consider the following descriptions, ask yourself if you see any of your own or your organization's behavior in them. 1. Ignore, deny. A typical beginning point for those who become ensnared in the victim cycle is the ignore or deny stage, where people pretend not to know there is a problem, remain unaware that the problem affects them, or choose to deny the problem altogether. For instance, many of us have witnessed this stage of the victim cycle play itself out over the past few decades as entire companies and industries in denial have fallen prey to smart competitors. First, the American steel industry denied the need to change and procrastinated its efforts to be more competitive, thus losing its predominance in the marketplace to the more advanced technology of the foreign competitors. Then the American automakers paid a terrible price for ignoring customers who wanted higher quality, more fuel-efficient cars. Denying the changes in consumer preferences, Detroit continued to believe that customers will drive whatever we build for them. Japanese automakers, on the other hand, operating from above the line, design cars better suited to the world's customers. How many industries will fall victim to their own denial by continuing to pretend not to know what will one day appear obvious? This stage in the victim cycle can prove devastatingly costly. People and companies, unwilling and unable to see what is really going on around them, court calamity and only begin to recognize the extent of their problems after the damage has been done. As a so-called superpower and leader among nations, you'd think America would have learned more from its below-the-line experiences over the past three decades. However, the challenge continues, as seen in the results of the Adult Literacy in America surveys released by the Department of Education. One four-year survey concluded that nearly half of the adults in the United States lack the literacy necessary for dealing effectively with modern life. A Time magazine article on the subject reports that roughly 90 million Americans over age 16, almost half that category's total population, are, as far as most workplaces are concerned, basically unfit for employment. Who is included in that definition? Those who can sign a credit card receipt, but are incapable of writing a letter when they think their bill is wrong. Those who can pay the correct change at the supermarket, but have difficulty calculating the difference between regular and sale prices. Those who can scan a newspaper story, but cannot paraphrase its contents. What price does American business pay for this lack of literacy? What is the price America will pay in the future for the inability to compete with other nations that have come to recognize their most important natural resource and educated people? The article continues. Perhaps the worst news from the survey was the hubris expressed by those who were tested. When asked if they read well or very well, 71% of those in the bottom grade said yes. If these surveys are accurate, the U.S. is not only significantly populated by people unprepared for current and advancing technologies, but most of them do not know that they do not know. At the other end of the educational spectrum, consider the studies that show 70 to 80% of graduating MBAs leaving their first job within the first 12 months out of school. Why do they leave? Not because they lack technical competence, but because they cannot function effectively in a real-world work environment, get along with people, and fit into a company's culture. Both graduating MBAs and business schools continue to deny the reality that it's not just what you do or what you know, but how you do it that determines success in business. When confronted with this reality, most business schools, management professors, and MBAs claim to appreciate the problem, but do they really? Some CEOs aren't as smart as they think they are either. When Enron CEO Jeffrey Skilling finally broke his silence about the company's demise, he denied any responsibility or wrongdoing. "We're all trying to figure out what happened," he told a New York Times reporter. "This was a tragedy. I had no idea the company was in anything but excellent shape." Tragedy, indeed. Enron had made every Wall Street analyst and business reporters list from Goldman Sachs to Fortune magazine as one of the world's most outstanding, futuristic companies. Now the company lay in ruins, with its former CEO claiming both innocence and ignorance. Obviously, Skilling was not a victim of adult illiteracy. He had just gotten stuck in the victim cycle. According to the New York Times, one financing arrangement that undermined Enron was a provision that required $3.9 billion in debts not on the balance sheet to be paid if the stock price dropped below certain levels, and Enron lost its investment-grade credit rating. Mr. Skilling said, "I did not know about that. You be the judge." And some are too smart for their own good. The Wall Street Journal reported that the Chambers Development Company, an acclaimed waste management firm, had overstated its profits by $362 million and had perpetuated many other accounting errors for several years after going public. Reporter Gabriella Stern characterized John G. Rangos Sr., the company's 63-year-old founder and CEO, as a man obsessed with making his garbage company a star and insistent on managers meeting his lofty profit goals, leading to an environment in which manipulating numbers was tolerated. After one executive told Rangos that his company would fall short of projected profits, Rangos told the executive to go find the rest of it. However, when auditors Grant Thornton refused to continue signing off on Chambers' numbers, the company's bright track record dimmed. In a report submitted by the accounting firm Deloitte & Touche, auditors revealed that Chambers Development covered its losses by grossly understating expenses and, in the process, violated generally accepted accounting principles. In response, John G. Rangos Jr. denied that his family in any way encouraged subordinates to manipulate earnings figures or use inappropriate accounting practices. Chambers Development Company and its CEO obviously ducked its accountability and denied their involvement in any wrongdoing. Mark Twain captured the challenge of the ignore-deny stage of the victim cycle when he said, "It's not what you don't know, it's what you know that just ain't so." Pretending not to know or ignoring a problem will keep you below the line and impair your ability to get results. Number two, it's not my job. How many times have we heard and perhaps even spoken the words, "It's not my job"? This age-old excuse is a well-worn phrase that has been used in countless discussions to excuse inaction, to redirect blame, and to avoid responsibility. This stage reflects an awareness that something needs to be done to get the result, coupled with an acute avoidance of getting involved. People, assuming this victim attitude, seek shelter from what they perceive to be additional effort without sufficient reward, from personal sacrifice without benefit. Why take on this added responsibility? "It's not my job" gained legitimacy in a past era of job descriptions that set boundaries across which no worker dared to step, of performance expectations that focused on individuals' ability to do their jobs rather than on their ability to contribute to getting the result, and of organizations that assumed it was okay for other departments to fight for what they needed instead of working for what would best benefit the company. No matter where you look, at work or at home, you will see examples of this stage of the victim cycle every day. For instance, can you recall a time when you were on the other side of "it's not my job"? Imagine the following scenario. You walk into a store seeking help, encouraged by the company's heavily advertised slogan, which reads, "We do what it takes to make you happy." You are shocked to hear, "I'm sorry, but I can't help you. That's not my job." Nothing infuriates most people more than becoming a pawn in an endless cycle of "it's not my job" as you bounce from one person to the next, finding no one willing to take responsibility. The price of such below-the-line behavior becomes onerous when you must pay it, which is precisely the point. Whenever people use this phrase to duck responsibility, avoiding the opportunity to play a role in getting results, someone pays the price. It may be an indirect price. It may even be difficult to trace. But ultimately, someone pays a price. Perhaps the price includes how others perceive you. Perhaps it involves how the company's performance ultimately affects your pay. Or perhaps it will accumulate until you lose your job or your company goes out of business. In the end, "it's not my job" means, "don't blame me, it's not my fault." Number three, finger pointing. In this well-practiced stage of the victim cycle, people deny their own responsibility for poor results and seek to shift the blame to others. "Don't blame me" becomes the catchphrase for transferring fault to the other guy. For instance, the chief operating officer of a leading healthcare company publicly admitted that a problem with its polyurethane extrusion process was perplexing everyone in the company. As soon as company employees became aware of the COO's admission, they began using the extrusion process excuse for all sorts of product defects, scheduling delays, and inefficiencies. Productivity and profitability plummeted as hundreds of employees pointed their fingers in every direction but at themselves. Blaming can take on many forms, and it occurs in even the best of companies. Herman Miller, the furniture manufacturer, widely respected as one of the best-managed American companies, engaged in a bit of finger-pointing itself. The company's marketing copywriters, keeping in mind the company's heralded commitment to customer satisfaction, as outlined in the best-selling book Leadership is an Art by CEO Max Dupree, pasted the following statement for placement on all Herman Miller shipping cartons. This furniture has been carefully inspected before being packed for shipment. It was in perfect condition when packed and received by the transportation company for shipment and delivery to you. If, when you open this crate or carton, you find that the piece of furniture has been damaged, hold shipment intact and call the transportation company immediately, requesting that they send an agent to supply you with an inspection report. This report is necessary along with the original freight bill to support a claim. Damage received during transit is the responsibility of the transportation company. If the above instructions are followed, we will be glad to assist in handling claims. Herman Miller, Incorporated. That disclaimer lays the groundwork for Herman Miller to point the finger at the transportation company if anything goes wrong, and it reveals a below-the-line attitude toward customer satisfaction. To Herman Miller's credit, the company's vice president of corporate quality issued the following statement in response to customer feedback. The notice, as it now stands, communicates a feeling of, we did our jobs. If it's wrong, it must be the other guy's fault. Not desiring to play the victim game by blaming or appearing to blame others, the company changed the label to read, this furniture has been crafted with pride and care and reflects our commitment to supply you with the best products available in the world. If, when you open this crate or carton, you notice that the piece of furniture has been damaged, hold the shipment and the original freight bill intact and call your Herman Miller dealer immediately. The transportation company should send an agent to supply you with an inspection report. This report is necessary along with the original freight bill to support the damage claim. We are fully committed to your complete satisfaction and ask only that you follow the above procedure in the event of product damage during shipment. Unfortunately, many other companies keep indulging in blame games, marketing blames R&D for designing products or features that marketing doesn't need instead of the ones marketing knows the customer wants. Sales attacks marketing for such inadequate support as ill-conceived brochures or mistargeted commercials. Manufacturing accuses sales of signing off on poor forecasts that cause either too many back orders or too much inventory. R&D points the finger at manufacturing for not resolving manufacturability problems on the factory floor. Vice presidents heap scorn on directors for not taking more responsibility, while directors chide vice presidents for either not providing sufficient guidelines or not letting go. Around and around it goes, a merry-go-round of accusations that do nothing to solve an organization's problems. Number 4. Confusion, tell me what to do. At this more subtle stage of the victim cycle, people cite confusion as a way of alleviating themselves of their accountability. If they don't understand the problem or the situation, surely they can't be expected to do anything about it. For example, a quality assurance manager at a major chemical company received from his superiors comprehensive and confidential feedback about his department's poor performance. After he had thoroughly researched the problem himself, however, he heard so many conflicting reasons for it that he felt completely baffled. Approaching his boss, he confessed his confusion, saying, "Given all these mixed signals, how can you hold me responsible for this mess?" Another manager at a large food processing company received a mixed review from her boss during a performance appraisal session. "You do some things well, other things not so well." Given the mixed review, the boss asked the manager to think about the feedback and respond to it within a week. The manager, befuddled by the appraisal, complained to her husband, her peers, and her subordinates during the week that her boss's evaluation made no sense. "He just doesn't understand me." Rather than seek clarification, the manager opted to remain confused and resentful. When she met with her boss to discuss her reactions, she complained that he had sent her such mixed signals that she couldn't possibly initiate any changes in her approach to her job. "I don't think that's wise," cautioned her boss. "What about the negative feedback I gave you? That was pretty clear." "Well, it wasn't to me," she replied. "I expected the review session to stimulate some changes that would further your growth and development with the company," her boss countered. "You just don't understand me," was the employee's response. "You're right. I don't," was the boss's answer. Within a few months, the manager left the company to take another job. Unfortunately, she allowed herself to remain as confused as ever, hoping somehow that a change of scenery would clarify things. It didn't. It seldom does. Out of the finger-pointing and confusion stages, naturally grows the response. Just tell me exactly what you want me to do, and I'll do it. Unfortunately, such a plea, while seeming to indicate a willingness to change behavior, simply transfers accountability to a superior or someone else. Too many bosses perpetuate such an attitude by telling their people exactly what to do in difficult situations. Asking someone else to tell you exactly what to do represents nothing more than an advanced form of excuse-making because it stems from the victim's desire to prepare his or her excuse before ever taking action. In the view of codependency expert Abe Wagner, author of The Transactional Manager, people display three ego states of the child: the natural child, the compliant child, and the rebellious child. The natural child refers to the part of the personality that someone inherits at birth, and it characterizes an individual's inherent needs, wants, and feelings. When children or adults display their natural child, they do what they want to do and don't do what they don't want to do. Such behavior can be natural and positive. However, the behavior of both the compliant and rebellious child reflect codependent relationships with respect to mother's wishes. Each of these codependent postures illustrates the below-the-line, tell-me-what-to-do stage of the victim cycle, because they depend on someone else assuming responsibility. Compliant children do what a mother or boss tells them to do, then transfer to mothers or bosses the consequences of the children's actions. Rebellious children find out what mothers or bosses want them to do, and then they defy it, all the while blaming mothers or bosses for all negative consequences. Whether codependents comply or rebel, their behavior depends on what a superior tells them to do. They never assume their own accountability. Unfortunately, far too many people in organizations act like compliant or rebellious children. Most of us have probably found ourselves in a similar endless circular pattern of tell me what to do. It plays itself out in business every day as people try to shift accountability by refusing to take responsibility for their future actions. Corporate cultures of the past that relied heavily on a command and control model provided a paternalistic approach to employee involvement that promoted this stage of the victim cycle. You just do what you are told, do it well, and we will take care of you for the rest of your life. Some people still depict their organizations as places where you begin work in the morning by checking your brain at the front door. However, most organizations today are fleeing from this tell-me-what-to-do model in an effort to create an environment that attracts, develops, and retains the best and the brightest people. As accountability deepens and people move above the line within the organization, a shift occurs from tell me what to do to here's what I'm going to do, what do you think? A truly profound and empowering approach to getting results. Number 5. Cover your tail. The penultimate stage of the victim cycle is cover your tail, where people continue to seek imagined protection below the line by crafting elaborate and precise stories as to why they couldn't possibly be blamed for something that might go wrong. These stories usually got fabricated after the fact. However, as amazing as it may seem, many excuse makers prepare these stories before the results come in or are even known, just in case an eventual problem or potential failure should occur. Cover your tail comes in many forms, ranging from documenting everything in writing to sending backup email messages that can be used as later proof of innocence. Most of us have experienced someone coming to substantiate a sequence of events or a series of conversations in order to substantiate an alibi. Sometimes the cover your tail stage of the victim cycle plays itself out more subtly. We have witnessed individuals who actually run and hide in order to disassociate themselves from situations that could erupt into potential problems. They avoid meetings where they might be put on the line, or they fail to open mail that they know might bear some anticipated bad news. We remember hearing of one such example where a particular company, at a critical juncture of its development and growth, was preparing for an upcoming government inspection that would either make or break the company. Mere days before the inspection, the president of the company announced that he was going on vacation and would not be available for any communication or decision-making during the inspection. Immediately, people felt the burden of potential problems totally shift to them, leaving the president seemingly in the clear. They scrambled to avoid the fallout. The effort expended to cover your tail almost always produces little more than reasons and justifications for why people are not responsible, not to blame, and not accountable for things that go wrong. While some situations may warrant such behavior, such as when you must defend yourself against unscrupulous people set on taking advantage of you, even then, cover your tail behavior drains both the time and resources of all involved. And number 6, wait and see. Initially, people remain mired in the victim cycle when they choose to wait and see if things will get better. In such a climate, however, problems can only get worse. For example, the senior management team of a $300 million personal care products manufacturer and marketer found themselves struggling over the introduction of a new product line. Because the company had grown so rapidly, it lacked clear precedence for such an introduction. After hours of fruitless debate, company officials decided to wait and see if the right approach might emerge naturally from the product management group after everyone's emotions cooled down. As months of indecision slipped by, a smaller competitor beat them to the punch, making the whole product introduction problem moot. The wait-and-see stage of the victim cycle often becomes a sinkhole where possible solutions get swallowed up in a swamp of inaction. In an amusing example of this phenomenon, the Wall Street Journal reported that bird droppings have been piling up for years in the Amherst, Massachusetts town hall attic, posing an increasing health risk to occupants. The Amherst Select Board voted to allocate $125,000 to clean up the mess, but according to contractors, the job could cost as much as $260,000. Enter a local hero, David Keenan, an Amherst real estate broker, who offered to organize a volunteer group called the Pigeon Busters, which would clean up the estimated 55 gallons of bird droppings for free. However, one of the select board members pointed out that such an effort would require insurance covering each of the volunteers, a far too expensive proposition. After listening to a lot of discussion, Keenan exclaimed in frustration, "Anyone who would volunteer would gladly sign a waiver. It's not a liability issue. The problem with the Amherst government is they won't roll up their sleeves and shovel the poop." When the community leaders hired lawyers to study the liability issue, the lawyers concluded, regardless of who does the cleanup, the town could still be sued. In the meantime, the bird dung keeps piling, with the people who come to town hall on business hoping they don't get psittacosis, a viral disease that can be transmitted from bird to man and develop into pneumonia. As a final resort, Keenan and his pigeon busters suggested that the select board allot enough money to fix the hole in the window frame through which the pigeons have been entering. Stuck in the victim cycle, the plight of Mike Eagle. People tend to remain in the victim cycle because they find a certain amount of at least temporary comfort below the line. They think, I don't have to admit I was wrong, I won't lose face, I don't have to do anything differently in the future, and I can justify my lack of performance and growth. For whatever reasons a person remains in the victim cycle, the comfort proves illusionary since they will never get out of it and move toward results until they learn to recognize the trap. Let's see how one CEO learned to spot the traps. We appreciate Mike Eagle, whom we rank today at the very top of those executives we know who model above-the-line leadership, for allowing us to share this story, because it sheds strong light on the inner struggles of executives today as they attempt to get and stay above the line. Mike Eagle had racked up a string of successes in his last corporate assignment as vice president of a manufacturing facility, and his advancements had impressed the higher-ups in his corporation. Everyone above him agreed that Mike would enjoy a spectacular future, probably at the top of the corporation's executive ranks. To further his career development, his superiors proposed a move to running a subsidiary company where he could bring his talents to bear on re-energizing a poorly performing organization. As Mike approached the end of his first year managing the company, however, he was feeling frustrated at the lack of improvement in its overall performance. Nothing he had tried seemed to be working, and for the first time in his career, he feared that he might fail in an assignment. With a performance issue continuing to frustrate him, Mike decided to explore the feelings of key people in the organization. During his investigation, he invited one of the supervisors to lunch, where he asked for candid feedback about people's perceptions of his impact on the company over the past year. Seemingly taken aback by this request, the supervisor asked Mike if he really wanted to hear the truth. When Mike insisted he did, the supervisor opened up, detailing how most people attributed lack of improvement to his own behavior. Mike couldn't believe what he was hearing. Eagle's in over his head. He's a manufacturing guy, and we need someone who knows our work. Mike hasn't made any difference at all. He's trying to run new product development the way he ran manufacturing. Mike's not doing anything to increase quality. He's not communicating clearly. He's ignoring significant personality conflicts on his own team. Eagle doesn't seem capable of making tough decisions. Although shocked by this realization of people's negative feelings about his management skills, Mike expressed appreciation for the candor of those observations. While he really did appreciate the feedback, he also found himself sorely aggravated by it. After all, when he headed up the manufacturing facility in his last job, he constantly heard people complaining. All we need is for R&D to quit throwing products over the wall before it has solved the design problems that make quality manufacturing impossible. This memory prompted Mike to chalk up the feedback as just so many sour grapes. Why couldn't the company accept the blame for its own flaws? The following Saturday, he went biking up the California coast with a former colleague and trusted friend whom we shall call Pete Sanders. Pete had started his own business just as Mike took on his new assignment. It didn't take long after beginning the ride for Mike and Pete to start reminiscing about the good times they spent together over the years. As the casual conversation unfolded, Pete asked Mike how things were going, and since Mike trusted Pete, he told him that the situation had turned into a nightmare. Before long, he was venting all his pent-up frustrations to his friend. "Pete, I've inherited a basket case, and it really upsets me that people expect me to do something to solve their problems. I didn't create the mess. They did. When I decided to take this position 12 months ago, I had no idea what I was getting myself into. No one on the board told me how bad it really was. I'm between a rock and a hard place. Managers at every level deny responsibility, and so does corporate management. Morale has sunk to a new low. At least 3 lower-level people quit every week, no matter what I do, and I've tried everything. But no one communicates with anyone else, and everyone blames everyone else for their problems. It seems like the CEO before me let things get completely out of control. The volume of new product introduction is pitiful, and the products that we do get from new product development aren't ready when we get them. I can't solve all these problems myself. I'm all alone out there. Corporate management doesn't provide any useful direction. They just assume that I'll do the right thing." For his part, Pete could not believe this was his old friend talking. Back at the plant, Mike had acted with supreme confidence, a take-charge guy who felt he could solve any problem thrown his way. Now he was sounding desperate, with his reasoning looping around in circles. He blamed the corporate management team for putting him in this untenable situation. He blamed his own senior team for not owning up to their problems, but he blamed himself for getting blindsided by a set of circumstances over which he felt no control whatsoever. Although Pete sympathized with Mike, saying he knew there must be plenty of good reasons for why he was feeling the way he did, he also observed that continuing to feel victimized would not help him move an inch toward the results he wanted. Pete concluded, "You know, Mike, I attended an interesting accountability workshop a few weeks ago, and based on what I learned there, I'd say you're stuck in what the workshop leaders call the victim cycle. That's the bad news. The good news is that you can do something about it." Getting unstuck, Mike Eagle's recognition. As Mike and Pete rode up the coast, Pete continued his explanation. "In this workshop, I learned that everyone falls into the victim cycle from time to time. It's nothing to feel ashamed about. In fact, if you can only learn to see when you're falling into it, you can start getting out of it. Victims never accomplish anything unless they start taking control over their own futures. The key is accountability, but you can't climb what they call the steps to accountability without first developing a full understanding of the victim cycle. Think about it. Have you been claiming to be unaware of certain circumstances, pretending not to know what's really going on, denying that it's your responsibility, blaming others, attempting to get someone else to take you off the hook and tell you what to do, arguing that you can't do anything or waiting for things to get better tomorrow?" These words seemed to strike a nerve in his friend, so Pete continued gently yet forcefully to help Mike see himself and his behavior more objectively. "Mike, I really respect you. Remember, getting stuck in the victim cycle is not bad, it's just not effective. It keeps you from getting results. Now I can see hundreds of times when I was in the victim cycle, and that's good, Mike. The more quickly I can recognize the trap, the more quickly I can get out of it and start working more productively toward my goals. The problems you face in the company are real. I saw it myself. But given those problems, try asking yourself what else you can do to rise above those circumstances and get the results you want. When you described your situation, I didn't hear many words expressing your ownership for what's happened over the past year. You talk as if the managers aren't really your managers, as if the company's problems are something you inherited, that you had no choice in the matter. Did you ever really completely leave your old job for this new position? Have you really shown up to make it happen here? Mike thought about all that, and the more he thought about it, the madder he got. You make it sound like I'm to blame for everybody else's problems. I don't buy that. When Pete remained silent, Mike took a deep breath, then apologized for his tirade. I'm sorry. I guess if I were totally honest with myself, I would have to acknowledge that I haven't really brought my best efforts to bear in the situation. The only fun I have lately is when I think about the good old days in manufacturing. Things went so smoothly then. Improvements were so visible. It all comes back when I review the weekly update report on my old projects that I still get. I always call my old friends to congratulate them and give them advice. At this point, Pete interrupted Mike by saying, "Do you remember the story about Alexander the Great? When Alexander's army reached the coast of what is now called India, he ordered his men to burn their ships. When the men hesitated at such a shocking order, Alexander responded, 'We're either going home in their ships, or we're not going home at all.' In other words, burning the ships would cement his army's commitment to conquest, because retreat would cease to be an option. Now victory could become the sole objective." Pete continued by suggesting that it looked to him as if Mike had kept a boat handy for retreat or escape, and thus had never completely committed to winning his battle. When he asked Mike if that were the case, Mike confided with a certain level of pride that he had several escape plans. He'd already hinted to his superiors that he might like to move back to his old job, and he had even interviewed for a job with a competitor. Now, however, he could see that he had been operating with one eye on the exit, while his situation demanded that he keep both eyes on the job at hand. Finally, he was able to see that he really was stuck in an unproductive cycle, playing the victim when he should be taking decisive steps to improve conditions in the organization. Could he focus his full attention on the problem? As he did so, Mike came to realize that he needed to create a more cohesive team with his managers before any meaningful change could occur. To his regret, he had done little over the past year to foster a close team spirit between himself and the managers who reported to him. Instead, he had simply gone around the managers to the supervisors, getting together with them in early morning meetings to obtain their input and to give them direction. Mike acknowledged that he had essentially skirted his managers and, in effect, disempowered them as a management team. Strangely enough, Mike's recognition of his own accountability for the company's poor performance no longer made him feel angry or depressed, but increasingly exhilarated. Wanting to feed the feeling, Mike told Pete, "You know, I really have been getting in my own way and waiting for someone else to solve these problems. While it's true there are a lot of things that have happened that I had nothing to do with, I've allowed those things to distract me from focusing on the positive action I can take. And worst of all, my acting like a victim has given everyone else permission to do the same. Thinking about it now, I can even see that a lot of people throughout the organization are stuck the same way, ignoring problems, denying responsibilities, and blaming others. And as for me, I think I've let myself become so paralyzed by it all that even if I start acting differently, even if I start accepting full accountability for the company's performance, I could still fail. That scares me." Mike's realization took time and effort to accomplish. But with it, he, just like Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz, began to see his way home. He understood that it's okay to fall into the victim cycle from time to time because it's only human to do so. And it's also okay to feel a little scared of the possibility of failure. But the accountable person learns to overcome that fear by recognizing that success can only come from getting above the line and working hard to get better results. In Mike's case, his ownership became infectious, and his team rose to the occasion. With determination and some outstanding leadership, Mike led the company to record sales and profits. A couple of years into this endeavor, Mike was recognized by the president of the parent company with an award for achieving results that even they thought impossible. Mike ultimately became a member of the senior executive management team of this parent organization. The message? Sometimes you must be willing to burn all your other ships and grasp the helm of the one under your command. Doing so can stimulate the conviction and create the ownership necessary to get started on a new program of action that will help you rise above your circumstances. The shoes are on your feet. Now all you have to do is click your heels. The vital lesson, detecting signs of the victim cycle. Over the years, we've worked through a Mike Eagle type of truth-telling, soul-searching session with hundreds of executives, professionals, friends, and family. Every situation is different. Every person is unique. But everyone reaches a critical moment when he or she recognizes having been stuck in the victim cycle. Take a minute to think about what happened to Mike Eagle. For 12 months, he honestly believed he could not control the circumstances. Dwelling upon the bleakness of the situation, he chose to think he couldn't do anything about it, that no one could expect him to fix all the company's long-standing problems overnight. As a result, Mike had languished, unhappily and unproductively, until he recognized he was ducking responsibility by blaming former CEOs and other managers, asking the parent corporate management team to tell him what to do, claiming that he couldn't do anything more than what he was already doing, and waiting to see if things would get better on their own. Fortunately, when he finally saw how he'd become stuck in the victim cycle, he could commit himself fully to helping everyone in the organization solve their problems and obtain better results. Like Mike Eagle, every human being can fall below the line from time to time, but whenever you do so, you can't get back on track until you first acknowledge that you're incurring a high cost for functioning below the line. That's when you begin assuming a see-it attitude that gives you the perspective you need to get above the line and start climbing the accountability ladder. You'll begin reading about the see-it rung on the steps to accountability in the next chapter. But before you do, you might pause here to ask yourself a few penetrating questions which will help you spot below-the-line attitudes. Take a few minutes to examine your questions in the victim cycle self-examination. If the scenario in a given question has ever happened to you, check either yes or no in the appropriate spaces. As you read each question, ask yourself, has this ever happened to me? Or have I ever felt this way? Try to play your own best friend, answering the question as frankly as possible. Once you have completed the victim cycle self-examination, total up your scores. Give yourself 1 point for every yes response and no points for every no response. After totaling your points, compare your total to the scoring table. Your actual score matters less than the recognition that, as a normal human being, you can be tempted at almost any time to avoid accountability for the false security and imagined safety of the victim cycle, where it's always someone else's fault that you're not getting results. The recognition that you can fall below the line sets the stage for you to experience the Oz principle, to rise above your circumstances and achieve the results you desire. Moving out of the victim cycle. Throughout this chapter, you have seen examples of below-the-line attitudes and behavior that should help you more fully appreciate the difference between victimization and accountability. However, just as Dorothy discovered on the yellow brick road to the Emerald City, you will have to work hard to spot victimization attitudes and behavior in your own life and in the operations of your organization. In the next chapter, you'll begin seeing accountability in a whole new light as you prepare yourself to climb the 4 steps to greater accountability. Chapter 3. There's no place like home, focusing on results. But you've not yet told me how to get back to Kansas. Your silver shoes will carry you over the desert, replies Glinda. If you had known their power, you could have gone back to your Aunt Em the very first day you came to this country. But then I should not have had my wonderful brains, cried the Scarecrow. I might have passed my whole life in the farmer's cornfield. And I should not have had my lovely heart, said the Tin Woodsman. I might have stood and rusted in the forest until the end of the world. "And I should have lived a coward forever," declared the lion, "and no beast in all the forest would have had a good word to say to me." "This is all true," said Dorothy, "and I'm glad I was of use to these good friends. But now that each of them has had what he most desired, and each is happy in having a kingdom to rule beside, I think I should like to go back to Kansas." The Wizard of Oz, L. Frank Baum. Citigroup, a world leader in global finance, earned more than $16 billion in profits in 2002. But did the company earn the money honestly? Citi and its Solomon Smith Barney unit have generated a lot of news because they allegedly helped Enron keep its debt off the balance sheet, marketed questionable WorldCom debt, promoted Windstar when it was going down the tubes, rewarded telecom executives with IPOs, and raised AT&T's market rating to win its business. Time to quit, run or hide? Not Citi CEO Sandy Weill. He told the business press, "I'm embarrassed." He admitted that Citi made some mistakes while he was CEO, and he accepted personal accountability, saying, "I'm part of those mistakes." He told his board that he would make it his top priority to make sure Citigroup operates more ethically and honestly. Is it all confessional rhetoric designed to appease an enraged public by admitting wrongdoing? Only time will tell. Yes, many other companies in the investment banking industry have pursued practices similar to Citi's and Solomon's. But that's no longer an acceptable excuse. What will Citigroup executives think and feel and do behind the scenes? We'll find out soon enough. To Weill's credit, he has made some impressive moves, firing star analyst Jack Grubman, releasing Solomon's top boss, and expensing stock options. Still, many observers chalk up what happened at Citigroup as a massive management failure. Will Weill's confessions and concessions help bring Citigroup back to respectability and keep it from faltering? That will depend on how much accountability for real results Sandy Weill and his executive team can muster over the next 5 to 10 years. Accountability poorly defined. Over a decade of experience working with thousands of managers, leaders, and team members has shown us that most people view accountability as something that happens to them when performance wanes, problems develop, or results fail to materialize. In fact, many think accountability only crops up when something goes wrong or when someone else wants to pinpoint the cause of the problem, all for the sake of pinning blame and pointing the finger. When things are sailing along smoothly and failure has not yet sunk the ship, people rarely ask, who is accountable for this success? It seems that only when the hull springs a leak does anyone start looking around for the responsible party. Not surprisingly, most dictionaries present a definition of accountability that promotes this somewhat negative view. Consider Webster's definition: subject to having to report, explain, or justify, being answerable, responsible. Notice how the definition begins with the words "subject to," implying little choice in the matter. This confession-oriented and powerless definition suggests what we have all observed: accountability viewed as a consequence for poor performance, a principle you should fear because it can only end up hurting you. Since most people experience accountability this way, it's no wonder they spend so much time shunning it and explaining and justifying poor results. We have learned over the years that when a leader announces that he or she has embarked on a campaign to create greater accountability in the organization, people often first respond with a moan, "Not more of that." Fearing the worst, they await more scrutiny to identify the culprits responsible for failed results. No wonder the blame game is so rampant and played so well and so creatively. However, we have learned through firsthand experience that a more positive and powerful definition of accountability can do more to achieve outstanding results than all the finger-pointing and blaming in the world. Take, for instance, Sandy Weill's case. We honor his willingness to stand up and take the blame, but did he do so only because things had gone so terribly wrong and the time had finally come to determine fault? Whether through blame or self-admission, we must come to understand that accountability is more than a confession. If we are not careful, we may even confuse the act of taking responsibility for failure as some sort of compensation for a lack of success. This fear-inducing approach to accountability has caused millions of people in thousands of organizations to to expend their valuable time and energy justifying their lack of performance with such tired excuses as, "We were over budget, overextended, overloaded, underinformed, underfunded, and underutilized." Justification then becomes the aim, damaging or replacing a conscientious focus on what else can be done to achieve results. One leader, intently focused on improving the performance of his people, suggested that his organization could save a lot of time and energy by handing out a list of tried and tested excuses, so that employees would need only to recite a number when explaining failure. This list sounds pretty silly, doesn't it? Yet in some way or another, people weave these excuses so deeply into the fabric of their lives that they resort to them without really thinking about what they're really saying. To overcome that impulse, people must abandon the past-oriented, blame-centered, whodunit definition of accountability. Almost without exception, when things go wrong, people start playing the whodunit game, a not-so-subtle variation of the blame game, as they immediately begin identifying the person in the group most responsible for the failure. All too often, the whodunit game excludes any intention of rectifying the situation. Instead, in an effort to avoid the career-limiting consequences of failure, those who play the game seek only to make sure the spotlight shifts to someone else, while they themselves die for the shelter of excuses, explanations, justifications, and disassociations. A tragic example of the whodunit game received national attention when it was reported that contaminated meat in hamburgers sold at Jack in the Box restaurants caused the death of 2 children and severe sickness in scores of others. Jack in the Box quickly prepared its explanation, pointing the finger at the supplier of the meat, Vons Grocery Stores, which of course had already prepared its own explanation, blaming the meat inspector, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which in turn explained that insufficient funds made it impossible to employ enough meat inspectors. So who's at fault? The taxpayers, who don't want more taxes for more inspectors. However, the taxpayers had prepared their own explanation. If the federal bureaucracy were only more efficient, it wouldn't cost so much to get the services we need. And the game goes on and on, further robbing organizations up and down the line of a means to get better results, genuine and positive accountability. As the downward spiral continues, fueled by a wrong-headed definition of accountability, more and more people are learning to become adept at playing the whodunit game. When a major project commences, people at all levels of the organization begin taking copious notes about the unfolding progress, not to document success, but to justify the lack of results if and when the project fails. The amount of wasted time and energy, even in the most quality-conscious organizational environments, continues to rise as the whodunit game turns into the craft your story game, which allows its players to build a handy excuse regardless of the outcome. Sadly, people have learned that they live in a litigious society that loves to place blame and fix accountability on someone else so that party can pay for the mistake. In such a society, winning the game of life equals covering your tail. By defining accountability in this way, people perpetuate a powerless, reactive view of it, one obsessed with the past and blissfully ignorant of the future. Consumed with dotting the I's and crossing the T's of their elaborate explanations for why they're not responsible, people today are robbing themselves of the power of accountability, a power that the Oz principle defines as the key to a successful future. A powerful definition of accountability.